For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
So, good morning, everybody. Some of us are sitting all day, and a number have come in for just this period of sitting and the talk, so thank you. Today I want to talk about the Eightfold Path as a Bodhisattva practice. Most of you are probably familiar with those terms. Very briefly, Bodhisattva practice is the Mahayana practice of making the efforts of our entire practice, Zazen and otherwise, be for the benefit of all beings, be for the awakening of all sentient beings. The Eightfold Path is an early, one of the first sort of maps or schemas of the Buddhist path to be articulated, and kind of predates the consolidation of Zen as a unique tradition. So, you know, some of you are familiar with the Bodhisattva vow, the first line of which is, "Beings are numberless, I vow to save them." Many of us find that a little shocking, a little daunting. The language is pretty elevated there. So maybe it would be useful for the purposes of this talk to think about Bodhi practice as a practice in which the intention is to always, in our interactions with other people, other beings more widely, bring to the best of our capacity the two qualities of compassion and insider wisdom, which are sort of the cardinal virtues, I guess you could say, of that informs Mahayana practice. I don't want to talk about the Eightfold Path in detail in terms of the different parts of it, but I would like to outline it quickly. You know, so we're not going to be talking about, you know, right speech in detail, but I would like to sort of outline it just to refresh people's memory, and some of you, a few of you, may not have heard it before. So there are eight aspects of this path, and they break down into kind of another schema that's often presented in Buddhism. Practice is talked about as a unity of wisdom or insight and discipline or shila, very widely considered to include the ethical dimensions, for example, of our that are articulated in our precepts, and also kind of more quote unquote mundane aspects, how we actually, you know, move through the world, move through, you know, how we handle objects, how we relate to our environment. Some things that might not ordinarily be considered ethical in a sort of more narrow definition. And then the third part is samadhi or meditation, zazen, that kind of thing. You know, and in the long arc of the Buddhist tradition, you know, these are sort of thought about in slightly different ways, but that will do for now. So the two parts of these eight things that fall under the purview of wisdom are what we call right view or right understanding, which is sort of both where it inaugurates this process, you know, some insight into the reality that things are not quite right, life is problematic, and we want to do something about it. So that itself is wisdom. But then through the process of practicing the Eightfold Path, that's where, kind of in a sense, where we come back to. And, you know, and that sort of other turning, you know, then wisdom becomes a clearer apprehension. Sometime in the text it's talking about clear apprehension of non-separation, or what we call, might call a dependent co-arising, or sometimes emptiness, and of the three marks, that the three things that are said to imprint all of sentient being, which are impermanence, non-self, anatman, and dukkha, unsatisfactoriness. And then the second aspect of the wisdom grouping is right aspiration, which you can think about in many ways, but we might think about emotional intelligence, kind of an attitude towards our lives, kind of an orientation, a direction that we choose to take. Discipline, sila, that includes right speech, which is, you know, broadly speak, there's a lot to be said about it, but it's truthful, appropriately timed, non-harmful speech that avoids triviality, harshness, all that kind of thing. Anything avoids speaking in such a way that we create ill will or enmity. There's right action. These are what we largely means the precepts, which I won't enumerate here. But also, I mean, generally speaking, non-exploitation, living compassionately and wisely, you know, including the sort of discipline of, you know, getting ourselves to the cushion, if that's our path, and basically trying to live well and harmoniously. And then right livelihood, which kind of overlaps with some of these things. For lay people, the oldest texts talk about this basically as not doing things that involve arms, not involving yourselves in activities that would cloud the mind, you know, so overindulgence in drugs and alcohol, say, or complete abstinence, if according to some, things that are avoiding killing, things that cause, that take life, cheating, exploitation of all kinds, right? And then samadhi, the three spokes there are right effort, right mindfulness, and right, sometimes it's said, concentration, which may be a little misleading, but it's the making the effort in our meditation to, you know, one, do it, two, being willing to sort of, as they come up, reveal and sort of work through, dismiss unwholesome, unhelpful states of mind, and to allow room to cultivate, you know, wholesome, helpful frames of mind, that kind of thing. And generally just the application of a certain kind of energy to our lives and our practice. You know, right mindfulness is, you know, staying attentive throughout our lives, but in this context, in meditation, just being present to the rising and falling of phenomena going on in your mind. And then right kind of concentration, it's a word I don't like, but kind of a focus and a willingness to stay focused enough that you can actually relax into a kind of openness, a kind of samadhi. Now, as these things have, this Eightfold Path has been, you know, handled historically, it's been done in lots of different ways, and there are, you know, without going into the details again, there are two kinds of recurrent errors that you might say that sometimes occurred. One is a kind of instrumentalism, linearity, mechanism, such that these things are not seen as aspects, these eight things that work together, but as sort of sequential steps. And the danger of this, one danger of this, is what you see sometimes in some of the southern Asian countries, where it's sort of determined, well, you know, the best that lay people can do, which is what all of us are, is, you know, sort of pay attention to, you know, the five basic precepts of not killing, not stealing, not lying, not clouding the mind, and whatever the other one is, and then you and supporting the sangha, in other words, monks and nuns, in hopes of situating yourself for a better shot later at the real stuff, which here is considered to be meditation. And I think, you know, I think it, if you look back at the early texts, that's a view that's not really supported. I think the idea is that actually all people have the capacity, according to different circumstances, to practice all three aspects of this: wisdom, discipline, samadhi. All aspects of the Eightfold Path, in their different ways. In other words, take on a full Buddhist practice. The sort of alternate danger, perhaps you might say, and this, you know, this is a sort of notion that the sort of mundane stuff of like paying attention to things like right speech and right action, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, can be dispensed with because for whatever reason, certain hotshots among us may just cut right to wisdom, and that's all we need to pay attention to. So, you know, you see in some Mahayana texts, and I think this is probably taken wrongly, but kind of a dismissal of the Eightfold Path as a practice suitable to the so-called hearers, for example, of the lesser vehicle, as opposed to the Bodhisattva practice. Well, you know, the problems with this we see regularly, unfortunately, on a regular basis. We, you know, you could say it's a kind of a danger of antinomianism. If you know, you don't have to pay attention to form, you don't have to pay attention to ethical discipline, that kind of thing. And, you know, we see the sad history of teachers and practitioners who thought they could dispense with that stuff and rely only on their, you know, quote, wisdom or their, quote, enlightenment, and this other stuff is secondary. I think that's also an error. So in some ways, both of these things indulge in what I think is too narrow a view of what we call the narrow path of the Eightfold Path. So in these things, we talk about, my time flies. We talk about, there's the word right, sama. And that's not, don't think about it in terms of like right as opposed to wrong or correct in terms of incorrect. The nuance seems to really be more in the range of proper, thoroughgoing, whole, integral, complete, that kind of stuff. So recall, some of you have seen the sort of icon of the Dharma wheel, right? This wheel with the eight spokes. Those are the branches of the Eightfold Path, but clearly not a linear sequence. And I think that part of what that conveys to us is that these things work in unison to sort of turn the wheel of Dharma. You know, there's a necessary interconnection and mutual dependence. So fundamentally, we don't practice these things as a series, but as sort of one integrated practice with a multiplicity of aspects or features. And if you think about, you know, the place of the Eightfold Path in the teaching, it's the fourth of the Four Noble Truths, you know, the reality of dukkha, the fact that dukkha has a cause. Because it has a cause, there are things that can be used to address the problem of dukkha, and then, boom, we get the Eightfold Path. These are the things that you can do to help work with this experience of unsatisfactoriness that we all seem to have. So it starts with dukkha, and it's answered dukkha. And if you think about the term dukkha, I don't know if this is true. I've heard that etymologically, it has to do with this notion of a wheel that doesn't spin properly on its axis. So there's wobble, there's friction, there's tension, there's wear, there's tear. And so part of the task is to make things sort of unfold, spin, if you will. a little bit more smoothly. I'm a bicyclist, so I think in bicycling, you talk, these things can happen to your wheels. They can go out of round and they go out of true. And so out of round is when hit a curb or whatever, and all of a sudden your wheel is not actually circular, it's kind of oblong or whatever, so you're riding along, you get a boom, boom, boom. You can also go out of true. That's where the tensions on the spokes get misaligned, and so instead of like spinning straightly, it kind of, there's a shh. And so I think it's helpful to think about, you know, our practice of the Eightfold Path is a practice of making our practice round and true in the sense I talked about before. Whole, thorough, integral, complete, da da da. You know, so in talking about how we do that, I think it's useful to talk about the parts. Talk about relationships, different kinds of relationships. The first one, you know, that I'd like to mention is the relationship of the different parts, you know, the different aspects of the Eightfold Path to each other. You know, and broadly speaking, you know, you can do this other sort of breakdown, and we can think of some of them as kind of in some sense internal. You know, samadhi, zazen, isn't that an internal process? You know, and then this other things, right speech, right livelihood, isn't that things I do out in the world, you know, that in some sense external? And so, you know, how do those connect? And I think there's a problem, you know, that's expressed differently, where we, you know, sometimes think, as in that example I use, like, okay, you slow learners or whatever, you just work on discipline. Maybe in another go, you can do these other things. And so there's this idea that one has to get all that side of their life together, and then one can get down to the more serious business of doing zazen, say. You know, conversely, sometimes there's this, it's a very closely, it's an obverse idea, actually. It's the same idea, just in reverse, which is the idea that we've got to really do, you know, our zazen well, and we'll get that down, and then we can behave correctly in the world and do right and do good things. I think both of these things are kind of a misrepresentation of how the Eightfold Path might be thought of, which is that these things inherently work together. It's not, you know, both of them are versions of, like, you've got to get your life entirely together before you can take on the full practice. That's just, in my view, wrong. Our lives are never going to be entirely together. And so if we take that approach, there's no avenue for practice. So these things do not work in isolation from each other. From the beginning and to the end, they work together and support each other. The, you know, as Suzuki Roshi says, you know, we breathe in and we go into an inner world. We breathe out and we go into the outer world. But really, it's just one world. It's truly, for each of us, just one world. And we've got to, I think, ideally, be working on both parts of these things together. So, following from that, you know, we can think about the relationship, if we can talk about it that way, of the Eightfold Path to ourselves. And it's very much, very close to what I just said. You know, the path, the Eightfold Path, it's, I think it's truly intended to address every aspect of our life. So even though we, you know, practically speaking, we might choose to emphasize or focus on one thing or the other, according to our own circumstances, our own karma, et cetera, at the end of the day, the practice as a totality involves working with all of this stuff at the same time. Working from the beginning with wisdom, working from the beginning with discipline, working from the beginning with samadhi. Not waiting for, say, wisdom to fully manifest before we try and help actively and skillfully in the world, and we get all our, you know, getting all our external relationships straightened out and stuff before we commit to zazen. you know, just I think it's better, it's more productive to start with the recognition that we'll act unskillfully and make mistakes, but through practice we can sort of get better, more skillful, more helpful, more bodhisattvic. And part of this implies that we have to accept from the start, difficult as it is, that in some sense we are, you know, worthy now of practicing the Dharma, you know, ready or not, no matter how screwed up we are. There's no other time, there's no other place. We choose to form and execute the intention of trying to fulfill the bodhisattva path, or we don't. We always have that choice. You know, Dogen says, you know, here is the way. This is the place that realization unfolds. That's true for whoever you are, wherever you are. Practice is never about some other place. It's never about some other time. It's never about, you know, getting, you know, I mean, we do our best, right? But it's like our lives are never going to be entirely together. So if we sort of make that the prerequisite of engaging serious practice, there's no way to begin. So we can also talk about relationships to others, right? Right from the start, the Eightfold Path points very strongly outside of this thing that we think of as ourselves, and brings into the picture others, right? Certainly right speech has an internal dimension of how we talk to ourselves, how we think discursively, and everything. But, you know, and that's really important, but in a way, it kind of is an extension of and follows from sort of the more primary role of speech in our life, which is to communicate with others, right? It's already, when we're talking about right speech, we're not just talking about me anymore. We're talking about us. Likewise, with the precepts, we're already, you know, there are, it's not, you know, yes, it's me who's making the, dedicating myself to trying to live up to the precepts, live out the precepts, but it already is not all about me or only about me. And so with livelihood and so on. So it's not that we get ourselves awake and then to impose on other people and on external circumstances the qualities of our awakeness. And it's not, it's just not one before the other. It's not zazen before discipline or ethics. It's not ethics before discipline. Rather, from the start, we're you know, working on all our relationships with all of the beginning, all of the beings, animate and inanimate, and that's integral to the process of our own awakening. In other words, awakening is not, in some sense, of course, it is something that can happen on the cushion, but that's not complete. The you know, rather it's how that you know, ultimately, it's about how that's lived out and expressed, not only on the cushion, but off the cushion as well, right? So, right from the beginning, there's a sense in which this effort that we're involved in is not a private process at all. Others are integrally involved from the very beginning. That's why, it's one reason why we talk about Sangha as a jewel. I mean, sometimes when we sort of live things out, we tend to think, well, you know, Sangha is really kind of maybe a little bit secondary because it's the thing that sort of supports and lets unfold the real stuff, which is Buddha and Dharma. But I think that's wrong. It's as much the case that Dharma supports and lets us live out Sangha. There, from all the way through, there's an equal status. And if you have Dharma, you have Buddha, you will have Sangha. If you have Sangha and you have Buddha, you have dharma, and you know, all those permutations. So practice involves opening to others, not sort of withdrawing into some sort of tiny field that we call ourselves and think we can control and perfect, and then we'll be happy and safe and snug and all that stuff. I think it follows from that that, you know, we often hear, particularly in the Zen world, that practice is not about self-improvement. It's not a self-help program, per se. But I think it's important to remember that it's not those things, too. There's this kind of double side to it. And that becoming more skillful and helpful and kinder, wiser, in all our interactions is essential. And that those things, trying and failing and trying again, all those things will enrich my zazen. And the more settled I become in my zazen, the more fully I'm able to, you know, act well in the world, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, part of what I'm trying to undo here is this, you know, these two different ideas I expressed at the beginning where, you know, we think that some kind of, intense focus on ourselves is a complete picture. It's always part of the picture, but it's never the entire picture. And doing that, you know, sort of reinforces me and you, right? Separation, which is, you know, what underlies the problem of dukkha in the first place, and part of what we're trying to do. So it's a matter of, you know, when we talk about the Eightfold Path, it's a matter of framing it, right? And I think the frame that we want to look at is bodhisattva practice. So all that I said before sort of suggests that in some real sense, what I call my practice is not entirely mine, and your practice is not entirely yours. You know, there's a bigger picture that comes into view, and that's the picture that we call dependent co-arising or non-separation, which is sometimes, you know, presented as the end of the bodhisattva, or end of the Eightfold Path, but it's also the beginning. You know, I think most of you have some familiarity with this idea of non-separation or pratityasamutpada. So we're not going to, don't have time to talk about it too much here, but I think that that's the framework in which a Mahayana practitioner can work with the Eightfold Path in these specific, in their specific aspects, and realize that in doing so, it's not simply, and never, even though we might begin with a misunderstanding that somehow it's about my happiness, my spiritual development, or my awakening. It's more than that. And it's not even just about me and you, or me and other people. It's a process that, as we grow in the practice, we come to see involves all beings. So you know, there's this expression, one for all for one. I think that kind of captures it. You know, it's like one for all for one. That means I have to make every effort as a person, as a limited being, from my seat, in my circumstances, to enact wisdom and compassion, and that we need to do that together. I have other stuff here, but I think I better stop just so we have a few minutes here. But I think that this is, you know, maybe kind of what Suzuki Roshi is getting at when there's this thing in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, where he says that what constitutes Zen practice, what specifically characterizes Zen practice, is a Hinayana discipline done in Mahayana spirit. And I think that we need to do our best to keep both of those in view at all times. So thank you very much. We've got, I think, do we start sitting again at 11? Akinian, at 11. Okay, so we've got about 10 minutes, more or less, if people have any responses or, you know, questions. We'll have, those of us who are staying, we'll have tea later, and we can do the, have a little more space, but maybe somebody's got something to say now.
Westerners, we are used to reaching a goal and then setting the next goal and then reaching the next goal and setting the next goal. So it's very helpful to remember that the path is somewhat circular and that even at times when you feel, because we can't help it, when we feel we're getting somewhere, then all of a sudden our life situation changes and we're knocked back where we felt we again. And then we don't understand what happened because we thought we were getting somewhere. So your talk was a good reminder that practice isn't so cut and dry and it's not so singular. And that the only way we could truly know where we're at in our practice is by going out into the world and seeing how we respond to different situations, different environments, and different people. So they do have a very intense interplay between each other. Like being reminded of that.
So, thank you. Yeah, as I stay with this, I'm always sort of impressed by, you know, how succinctly, you know, very simple things like an image, that Dharma wheel. There's you know, it seems like just kind of a logo or something, but no, it's quite a bit of information there. Kyoshin.
Thank you. I love the Eightfold Path too. So the way I like to think about it, because sometimes my friends ask me, you know, why do you do Zen? It seems so grim, such a downer, suffering, all that. But I think of it as guidance on how to live the best possible life. You know, it's not immediately obvious. We have limited time on the planet, and there's lots of choices. And the Eightfold Path really looks at every aspect of our work and our speech and our mind and our body, and it's a very helpful touchstone. You know, am I wasting time? Am I living the most joyous life I possibly can for myself and other beings? And it's helpful in, to me, an upper, not a downer.
Yeah.
It's not like rules. It's really touchstones or
guidance,
yeah. Like you had a really great mom who would give you a really smart step on how to live your life. Anyway, thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you for listening.